The struggle between freedom and tyranny is not confined to any one nation or region. It is a global theme that, sadly, is becoming increasingly relevant in our time. Around the world, we are witnessing signs of a rising authoritarianism, along with a concerning suppression of human rights and civil liberties. Yet, we also see the courage of those who choose to resist it. The ongoing fight for democracy and dignity in Myanmar stands as a stark example of this global struggle, illuminating a shared human yearning for freedom, justice, and self-determination. In this way, their fight is everyone's fight. And so with that in mind, let's get into today's show.
Torell. I'm a member of parliament in Sweden. I represent the Social Democratic Party and I serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee of the parliament, which is a standing committee handling Sweden's relations with other countries and development aid. And we also decide on deploying military personnel abroad. I served here in Parliament since 2006, so this is my fifth and final term in office. I've been engaged in Burma, Myanmar ever since 2006 when I was placed in the Foreign Affairs Committee and had the responsibility to keep an eye on what's going on in Southeast Asia and Asia beyond. I've had an interest in Myanmar issues for many years. Traveled there quite a few times, not in the last 3 or 4 years, but I try to keep up with what's going on and try to. Now we Social Democrats are in opposition. Sweden is governed by a three-party government, supported by a fourth party on the right side. And us in the center-left are in opposition. So I do what I can to keep Myanmar in focus somewhat in the shadow of Ukraine and Gaza and Trump's madness, whatever else is going on in the world that steals the attention from what's going on in Southeast Asia. So I try to do my best to write questions to the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Minister for Development Aid and Trade. And, that's me.
Thank you for that introduction and thank you for joining us here at Insight Myanmar podcast from the halls of Swedish Parliament where we are sitting conducting this interview. And as we get into your involvement with Myanmar and Sweden's involvement with Myanmar, I'd like to just have a brief understanding of yourself, personally, how you got into this. You come from a small town in Sweden. Your background is as a teacher. And I'm wondering if you can describe some of the values and that shaped your worldview in where you came from that placed you in the position you've been in and that you're in now and wanting to speak up for countries that are so far away from anything that shaped your past and where you came from.
Right. As you said, my background is in teaching. I'm from a small industrial town in what you would describe as the Rust Belt of Sweden. A very small place where everybody knows each other, very much working class, very much labor movement and social democratic governance for ever since democracy was introduced in Sweden. It's been governed by social democrats, and I was engaged in local politics before I was asked to be nominated for the national parliament. But my interest in international affairs became started long before that. When I was a young boy, my dad, who worked for a big Swedish company, was offered a job in South Africa. And my mom and dad were divorced, so I was given the choice to stay in my little town in Sweden or move with dad to Africa. I was 12 years old. I thought Africa sounded exciting, had no idea about apartheid or Nelson Mandela being in prison or anything, but I tagged along my dad and spent the next 3 years in South Africa from 79 to 81. And those are very formative years when you're from 12 to 15. So I learned a lot about racism, and I learned a lot about what a society can become if you let prejudice and division of people and not judging people for their character but the color of their skin, etc., what kind of society you get from that. Of course, I lived a privileged life in a big house with a pool with my dad. I went to a very posh Pretoria Boys High School, where all the white boys went. At the beginning, I was unaware, but I became more and more aware of what was going on around me. When I came back to Sweden as a young man, teenager, I was engaged in an anti-racist movement. I fought with skinheads and such, and these far-right youngsters. And eventually I got into politics as well, in my mid-20s, and was engaged in local politics. And I started my professional life. I taught Swedish for refugees and immigrants. And this was during the 90s, so I learned a lot about war and diplomacy by teaching refugees from the Balkans. And this was during the time of the Balkan War. So I had a classroom full of Serbs and Croats and Albanians and Bosniaks all together in the same classroom while the fighting was going on in their home country. So that honed my diplomatic skills. And I also got to learn about what happens in another way when a country falls apart, when there is division among neighbors and friends. And eventually I got into local politics in my hometown and happened to be nominated to parliament in 98 first, and then 2002, and then eventually in 2006 I was elected, and quite unexpectedly ended up in the Foreign Affairs Committee, because you can't, there are 15 committees in Parliament, and you can't choose yourself which committee you want to be in. You are selected among, well, there are many different wishes from new parliamentarians, and your wishes isn't the top priority, but I guess they saw something in me that was appropriate for foreign affairs. And I was interested in it, of course. It was one of my top choices, and I was surprised to get my top choice. My English speaking skills might be part of it, and also my background in sort of foreign relations without studying it in universities or such. And the first 4 years in parliament from 2006 to 2010, we were in opposition then as well, and I was handed responsibility for Asian affairs and got, and this was at the time of the what do you call the revolution, the monks taking to the street, and we saw these pictures of the orange-clad monks being shot and Aung San Suu Kyi being in prison. And so I joined, so I learned a lot from activists and advocacy groups here in Sweden, from on the Burma Committee, on our organization, the Olof Palme International Center, who has had activities in Burma for many years. I learned a lot from them. I traveled to the region. I met with people in Mae Sot and Chiang Mai in, on the Thai side. I met with activists traveling Europe to raise awareness on Burma. And my engagement grew through the years. In 2011, I was fortunate enough to be one of the first European politicians to meet with Aung San Suu Kyi when she was just released, just a couple of months after her first release. So we met with her in her villa at the by the lake there, under much secrecy. Traveling there, we had to be very careful because we didn't know if they were going to chuck her back in jail, or was it sensitive for people meeting with us and then meeting us being seen meeting her. So we didn't dare to meet anyone before we met her or afterwards. So we just dashed in and out. It was a fantastic meeting. That was before her halo sort of was and her reputation internationally was damaged later on. But at that time, it was like meeting Nelson Mandela or some iconic, or she is an iconic figure, of course, in world politics still. So that was quite an experience. And then when we came home from Myanmar, we thought we could make a big news event out of this. But at the same time that we sent our press message, Hosni Mubarak was ousted in Egypt, and the Tahrir Square news story swept across everything, and the Arabic Spring got started, and our news story sort of disappeared, and just we didn't make the headlines, unfortunately. But so that was the sort of the start of my engagement in Burma. I can speak about this for ages, but please go ahead.
No, this is wonderful, and I have questions going in so many directions from this. I guess the first one that springs to mind is you mention all of your engagements with in Thailand, in Burma, in Europe, of meeting any variety of activists, former political prisoners, those Burmese and ethnics that have been affected by the crisis. I want to prompt you if there's one anecdote among the many, many that must be there, something that really impacted you emotionally, that stayed in your mind, that continues to animate your engagement on this crisis, that you can share.
Well, I don't want to... I wouldn't want to name names or organizations that I met because it might be sensitive. Yeah. But of course, I had one during that, which we now see in the brief period of openness and democratic development that we saw between, when was that? Between around 2015 to 18 or something, when there was hope and when there was like positive development, of course, many troubles, and the constitution was marred, and there were huge challenges, but there was still, I could travel to Burma, I could meet with people. We met with a DPNS, I can mention them, a sister party of ours, and I traveled the country for a week together with activists from that party, and to see the people printing newspapers by hand. Yeah. No, like we did here in the 20s or 30s, oh. Old machinery, printing newsletters, and everywhere in the street. And I could compare with 2011 when I traveled there. There weren't any newspapers around, it was only government media. And to see the difference in plurality of expression coming back there in 2015, 16, was quite inspiring. I mean, Sweden is a very mature, old democracy. We take a lot of democratic development for granted, freedom of expression, the free media, etc. We take it for granted here. We think it's a given, but it's not. And it was really inspiring to see all these very poor people who you would expect to be busy just finding food for the day and a house, a roof over their heads, but they engage themselves in printing newsletters instead and spreading the word of democracy to other people. That was that was inspiring, really.
Yeah.
Oh, I can tell you more stories. Now I start remembering. You know, I'm such a busy guy. You know, my head is always full with what's current. Right now we work a lot on Gaza, and the plight of the Gaza people is top of mind. But it's good that you came to remind me. Another image I can convey to you is on that same trip, yes, we went to visit textile workers because us social democrats are always interested in the working conditions and unions. We were formed by the trade unions from the beginning, so we always try to have that aspect in our work as well. So we went to visit with the beginnings of a textile workers union in Yangon, and we went into that industrial zone where all the textile factories are, and I've seen slum and poverty and bad conditions previously, but that was really tough to see how the children were working there. You could see them work, young 7, 8, 10-year-old kids working, and you could see even younger kids playing in the puddles, the water. It's close to the sea, isn't it? And the river, so it had flooded and there were puddles all over. And these puddles were colored by the dye from the factories. So I have these clear images, and I took a few photos as well of kids, 3, 4-year-olds, playing in these puddles that were bright green or bright purple, pink, from chemicals and dye. Awful, really. Beautiful pictures, but awful situation. Yeah. So I keep those and their parents organizing themselves, trying to protest to get better working conditions and living wage. So I met with their parents as well. But the image that stuck in my head is these 3, 4-year-olds playing in this brightly colored puddles of dirty water.
Yeah. Right. Images that I'm sure still animate you to this day and bring you back to that crisis and the overall history of Burma. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how the early involvement with the Burma Project within the Swedish social democratic movement, what Burma represented to you back then as you came in as a relative novice to such an extremely complex situation of constant learning, and how your perception has then changed over time.
Yes. It is a complex society, a complex conflict, and Sweden's social democrats have always been an international part of an international movement. We focus greatly on international solidarity. We are as far from a nationalist party as you can be. Okay. And nowadays, with all the nationalists popping up, we are proud to say that we are internationalists, not nationalists. And our most famous party leader and prime minister was Olof Palme. He was assassinated in 86. He's famous for being assassinated nowadays. That's what kids know about him. But he was such an important figure in our history, but also in the geopolitical history of the world. He was a person who stood up for small countries and during the Cold War spoke for the rule of law and didn't accept taking sides. He criticized the US for the Vietnam War as harshly as he criticized the Soviet Union for the Afghanistan War or the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. And he actually traveled as a young man, late teens, early 20s, he traveled through Asia and to Burma and wrote about his experiences there. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he wrote about how terribly difficult the conflict was between the different peoples there and the colonization and then the independence and the different groups fighting each other. And he sort of wrote about, they've been fighting each other there for centuries. And he was sort of, this was during the anti-colonization movement in the late 50s. So he spoke about that, how naive the colonial powers are to think that they can govern a land that's that complex with so many languages and peoples and histories and factors that they don't understand at all. So, Social Democrats have been active in not just Swedish, but Norwegians, Danes, Norwegians especially have been active in Myanmar, Burma since the 60s, 70s. We have sponsored education in a democratic tradition, in humanitarian aid, but also Radio Free Burma, and together with the Norwegians. SIDA has been there since the 80s, I think. And my experience coming in there as a novice without having much understanding of what's going on, to today, almost 20 years later, I'm not sure that I know everything. I'm still asking questions. I'm still perplexed by the complexity. I'm still sort of wondering, that aspect you have to factor in as well. I didn't think about that. So it's a learning experience, really. What impresses me is the will of the people there and the patience of the people in mobilizing for a common good, trying to create something better out of the chaos that has been there since forever. And of course some have taken the struggle militarily, which I don't judge that, that's understandable. But so many people work for a peaceful solution, trying to build bridges between different ethnicities, religions, and trying to build a federal state and the formation of the national unity government and the constant resistance against oppression is very impressive and inspiring. And I've learned to listen to people who know more than myself on Burma. I don't pretend to be able to explain everything or have answers for everything. But I know that as long as we, as my party, as an interest here, as long as we take the side of human rights, international humanitarian law, and international law in general, the UN Charter, we won't make too many errors. Also respect the complexity of the situation and the different, not to really understand that Burma or Myanmar is a country of many, many peoples, a country of different traditions, languages, and a great diversity. To respect that in every sense is something I've learned is important.
Right. Now, you reference how not just Sweden, but Nordic countries have traditionally played a role, and I would argue an outsized role, in the support of humanitarian, human rights, democracy, media, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd like to prompt you to ask about, first of all, why you think this is, that this pocket of the world has just come on so strongly in support of these values when there are many other developed and Western countries that haven't risen to the occasion as famously as the Nordic countries have. And then that's the more optimistic side of the question. And then on the other hand, this tilt that we're seeing worldwide that is also impacting Nordic countries as well, of looking at reevaluating these traditional values and this traditional identity into looking at business and transactional and nationalistic endeavors, and that even in the strongholds, there's now a concern of backsliding and of shifting away.
Okay, let's start with the positive side then. Well, the Nordic countries have been very successful. We've reached a level of welfare and wealth in our societies that we can afford ourselves the luxury of caring about more than ourselves. And we made this journey quite rapidly. And in the 60s, 70s, we had wealth levels that were at the top of the world. And we could afford to be more internationalistic. And there is also the reason that Sweden and the Nordic countries are small countries. We're not superpowers. We're in a corner of the world, and we are dependent on other countries for economy, for trade, for workforce coming here and manning the industries in Sweden. We would never have been able to build our super successful industrial giants if we didn't have immigration from Finland and Norway, of course, to Sweden, but also from Turkey, from the Balkan states, from Spain and Italy. And the first pizzeria in my hometown was in the 60s, way before in many other European countries, because we had a lot of Italians that came here and they opened Italian delis and stuff. So we have this tradition of having open borders, not just for refugees and asylum seekers, but we understand that we are a corner of the world that need other peoples, and we're curious of other cultures and understand that we all are dependent of each other in this world. And during the Cold War, Sweden, not least through Olof Palme and Social Democrats, but also it was more than a political party thing. We saw ourselves as sort of the middle way. You don't have to choose communism or extreme capitalism. There is a third way. And in this way, we joined with other countries in the world that also didn't want to take sides. And we joined countries that were liberating themselves from colonial powers. And we had no colonial history or baggage. So we created good relations with these countries, many in Africa, in Latin America. And we've stood by their side in their independence struggles. Southeast Asia, on the other hand, is a bit different than Africa and Latin America because, as we were saying, it's another complex history there with struggles within the countries as well. But Myanmar sort of became an example of a place where we could do good, where we could help out, where development, the military rule there was terrible. We saw the uprising of the student movement, the Aung San Suu Kyi in the 80s, and it was a place where we thought we could do good. And Sweden at that time, contrary to what we see nowadays, we went to places where it was difficult, where the problems were the greatest, and the poverty was the worst, and the conflicts were the most complicated, and we tried to make a difference there. Nowadays, we see another paradigm where not just Sweden, but many countries go where there's something in it for ourselves, if it's trade-wise or geopolitically, strategically, security-wise, to stop migration from that place or whatever the reason may be. And we stay away from the most difficult conflicts and countries. And that's a sad shift, really. Myanmar and Sweden, Burma and Sweden have no connection, really, logically. I mean, South Korea and Sweden, I'm also very engaged in Sweden-Korea relations. We have a long history of adopted children from Korea coming to Sweden. Mm-hmm. So everybody here knows someone that looks Korean because they were adopted from there. So we have this connection, and Sweden sent troops there and a military hospital during the 50s in the war. We helped build a Korean healthcare system, all in all. So we have connections. Thailand, we have connections with Thailand through tourism. Half a million Swedes go to Thailand every year for vacation. And hopefully some of them are also a bit more aware of what's going on politically. Through the tsunami in 2003, Sweden was the Western country that was worst affected of all. We had hundreds of deaths there during the tsunami. And that created a connection with the Thai people. We don't have that with Myanmar, really, because it's been such an isolated country and not many Myanmar people in Sweden have made it here. But through civil society, the Swedish Burma Committee, and political governments in Sweden have focused on it. So there is even though we don't have much people-to-people exchange, there is still a sense of solidarity with Myanmar. And it's sort of like the last bastion of military juntas, you know, from the in the 70s and 80s, we fought countries with, we supported liberation movements in Argentina, in Chile, in Portugal, in Greece, many countries who had military rule. And Myanmar has sort of become the last bastion of military rule where we feel that we need to help out. And nowadays, the paradigm, I answered forever your questions. You don't get a word in. Sorry.
No, it's great. I appreciate this. I don't need to get a word in.
All right. Nowadays, then, if we see this paradigm shift that I spoke about, where countries are becoming more, where multilateralism is challenged, where borders, national borders have become more and more important, and these borders are not just lines on the map, they're also borders within minds of people, where you tend to see the interest of your own people in your own country and feel that if someone somewhere else gained something, you would lose something. And I think that's a mistake, thinking in that fashion. I mean, our ideology and my conviction is that what's good for poor people somewhere else is good for all of us. And I mean, human development is a global thing. It's not a national thing. I mean, if workers in Myanmar, in the textile factories there, get a better deal and better conditions, it's good for all of us. Because it will be a level playing ground, where a level field where we can compete on level terms. And I mean, being able to buy cheap t-shirts in Sweden is not a human right, you know. It's not. So nowadays we see not, I mean, my side of the politics, the center-left, have gone in that direction in some countries as well. We see how populism grows, nationalistic populism grows on both the left and right side. dominantly on the right side, of course, but we see these tendencies within parties that are in our family as well. And I'm glad that us Social Democrats here in Sweden, at least, and Norway, I would say, Finland, Denmark, maybe not as much, has stayed true to our international solidarity and has this understanding of solidarity being not something you do to be nice to people, something you do to be charitable or to feel sorry for someone, some poor sod somewhere else. It's a matter of we're all dependent on each other, and we are a global family. We are one people, even though we have different religions and skin color and cultures and national passports. We are one global family, and we need to take care of each other as a whole. And I'm glad that us here in Sweden, the Swedish Social Democrats, we stay true to that. When the voting public have gone to the right, has gone more nationalistic. And sadly enough, the younger you are, the more conservative you have become. And also there's a big gender gap, extreme gender gap, where the younger you are and the more male you are, the more likely you are to vote for right-wing populist nationalistic movements or parties. And that's something that's troubling if you look in the long run. So we try our best to reach out to younger people and to young men to see how our message can resonate with them as well. And I mean, being to focus on solidarity and helping others to develop is not against our self-interest. It is a part of our self-interest, but self-interest is not a narrow thing. Self-interest is something larger and wider. There is an enlightened self-interest in eradicating poverty, for example. That's good for all of us. Conflicts will be less, illegal migration will be less, risk of war becomes less if there is less poverty in the world. It's quite basic, isn't it? But instead, these populists have come and said that we have to watch out for our own, and as long as there are poor old age pensioners in Sweden, we shouldn't send $1 abroad to some foreigner who will just waste it on corruption. And there are all these myths about development aid and prejudice about foreigners and anti-Islamic sentiment that is just, it goes like a wildfire through society, and that's scary, and it's hard to counter. And I compare now with 2006 when I came into parliament, creating public opinion or trying to advocate for stuff, as the landscape has completely changed with social media, and very seldom do you have the chance, like we do today, to speak at length about something and making something a bit more complex.
Trying to
see from different angles.
Yeah.
It's all about 10-second sound bites, TikTok dances for 30 seconds, and GIFs and memes and trying to package a message so it flies and becomes viral on social media. And these algorithms are rigged to benefit strong emotions like anger and hate and fear and prejudice and laughter as well, but strong emotions. And these algorithms sort of are self-fulfilling. The more you see of one thing, the more you get of it. And the algorithm sort of is slanted to the one side because more of the same is always created. And nuance isn't benefited at all. Zones of or shades of gray, it's all black and white. There's no shades of gray. And politics and human development is shades of gray. There is no black and white. It's all, you can't always choose between a good thing and a bad thing. You have to choose between five different bad things of different character. And to explain that in a TikTok video is impossible. And unfortunately, people don't, and the younger you are, the more it's true, don't gather around the same set of information anymore. When I was young, I was born in late 60s, during my youth and young adulthood here in Sweden, everybody watched the same news show at 7:30. There was the national news on TV, on TV. There were two TV channels, on TV2 at 7:30, national news, and at 7:55 we had the weather report. And that was the weather report that was legitimate for the day after. I still can't call my dad at 5 to 8 in the evening because it's the weather report. Why are you calling me now? And so we had these campfires that we that we gathered around, and there were a few, a right-wing newspaper, a left-wing newspaper, but they were professional newspapers, and they are journalists, educated journalists, and they had an editorial section in the beginning, which was politically colored, but the rest was professional journalism, and people chose between the right-wing evening newspaper or the left-wing one, but they all read about the same world, you know, objectively reported. And we had two or three radio stations. We all watched the same entertainment shows on TV. We all followed the same sports heroes, you know. And the input into people was very similar. And some would become social democrats, some would become conservative. A few even became neo-Nazi nationalists, but they were a few hundred. And they didn't organize, and they didn't have access to the media, and they didn't have a TV channel of their own. So they were sort of on the side there, lunatics on the side. And on the far left, we had some Moscow faithful Trotskyists and some Maoists, but they were a few hundred as well. And they kept splitting up. So they had no power. So the mainstream was very wide. And nowadays, these campfires are gone. People have their own campfires. And there are millions of campfires where you gather together with the ones who agree with you. And it's not limited by national borders. It could be a group of, I don't know, cis incel men, for example, gather worldwide around the same social media accounts and groups, and they reinforce their own very strange view of the world, and they can't, and eventually they believe that this is the world as we know it, and everybody else is wrong. And etc. So there are these millions of campfires with people staring into their own little campfire, ignoring all the campfires around them. And this makes for a politically dangerous scenario where populists can grow limitlessly. And we have now in Sweden, the second biggest party in Sweden is the Sweden Democrats. A party has around 20% of the vote, and they were founded by Nazis in the late 80s. I mean, that's unfathomable, really. Yeah. In Sweden, the home of the liberal democracy, you know, neo-Nazis govern the government, and they are the biggest part of the government coalition. They don't have ministers because the other parties say, oh, well, we can't have them in government. We can't have ministers. But they get to tell us what to do. So it's an extreme situation in Sweden and in many other European countries. And Donald Trump was elected president. I mean, that's crazy. And this is because how the way people perceive the world has shifted completely. And I don't see an apparent way out of it. Because media is what it is, and people will have these individualized streams in their devices. And we need the democratic part of the world, the liberal forces of the world, need to unite and regulate this somehow so we can have a shift. Because I'm worried for the future of democracy.
I'm really interested how, in your discussion just now, you've contrasted these beautiful values that you espouse that were part of your upbringing, we can say your family and community upbringing, but also your national upbringing, and giving us that history into the background of Olof Palme and the development of Swedish mindset and culture, and yet you're building this this characterization of Swedish identity and cultural values with where we've turned into a TikTok fear-mongering generation of we're sitting around different campfires, we're all siloed, we aren't agreeing on the same facts that are in front of us. And that also makes me appreciate that we are able to have this long-form, nuanced, detailed conversation that is part of this media landscape and is hitting people in the right way. I'm certainly glad we're doing this instead of a TikTok video. I don't know how many people would watch that. I certainly wouldn't. But I want to get into, you know, what you're saying is impacting not only the global scale of the world and Sweden itself, but also getting back to Myanmar, it's impacting all of these things together. And so when you're looking at this shift that's happening now, and the real question I hear people asking is this part of the usual highs and lows and dark and down periods that then transition to something else? That's the more optimistic way to look at it. We're just in kind of a dangerous lull right now that we'll get back to some sense of normalcy. Or is this the beginning of something much more fragile and dangerous that is coming, and this is just the start of a kind of downsliding of authoritarianism, of the degradation of democracy and of the international order? So these wider questions that we're looking at. And so I guess the question for you, and this is a big question, so take it where you will, that on one end, this transition that we're looking at now is certainly affecting, just if we stay on Sweden, it's affecting Swedish values, identity, national interest, who Sweden is as a country and what Sweden is in the world, if that continues. But then looking at the relations that Sweden has with countries around the world, and certainly Myanmar, and the way you described it, there's no natural link connecting Sweden to Myanmar. But historically, you've described how Sweden went to the hardest places, the worst crises, the worst things that were happening, and tried to do good there. And so if it starts to renege on that age-old traditional responsibility, what does that then mean for Myanmar and for the Myanmars of the world? And so I guess what I'm curious about with you is, first, what, as far as you can tell in the position you're in, and I know that no one can predict the future, but what trends are you seeing in this being a lull or a downward progression that then we go back to some sense of normalization? And to what degree do you see this as an alarming trend that very well could continue? And then what implications do you see with that towards where Sweden is going, and then the Myanmar and the Myanmars of the world?
Mm. I know this saying, I never make predictions, and I never will. But I will now. Well, I believe if you look at history, there's a pendulum movement. If it goes extreme one way, the pendulum will eventually swing back. And I guess that's true, and that will happen now, but I don't know what normalcy is. was the liberal world order that we saw from the end of the Second World War until 2015 or 20, was that normalcy? Or is authoritarianism a feudal society? Is that normalcy? And was this world order of democratic development and liberal rights, was that an exception, a parenthesis in world history, and the middle of the pendulum movement is fragmentation and authoritarian rule and everybody looking to themselves at first? I'm not sure. I'd like to think that the ideal position or the normalcy should be a place where the UN Charter, a world where the UN Charter is viable, and we gather around human rights, and we believe that countries and peoples should be able to decide for themselves through democratic elections the future of their country, and wars will become fewer and further between. I hope so, and I want to believe so, and I have an optimistic view on man and humanity. I believe that man is inherently good and want to do good, and I need to be optimistic. There's a saying here from that I use sometimes, it's your damn obligation to be optimist. You need to be, otherwise what's the alternative? You might as well just go throw yourself in the river, if everything's going to shit anyway. So, But I believe in humanity, and I believe the will to become better, and I believe that man does not want to hurt each other. But man and humankind do bad things to each other for a variety, a multitude of reasons. But it's not normalcy. What happens in Gaza now, or in Rakhine State, or how the Myanmar government orders air raids on earthquake suffering people. Yeah. I mean, that's sick.
Yeah.
It's sick, but it doesn't mean that some people are evil and some are good, and it's a struggle between good and evil. I don't believe that. I believe every man can become, when you're born, you're a blank sheet. You know, you can become Adolf Hitler or Nelson Mandela. It's all about the conditions around you and what sentiments within you are being nurtured. And so I believe that the world there are, even though we're in a terrible place in many aspects in the world, there is good development as well. I mean, national borders have become less important because people are able to inform themselves of what's going on in the world. The revolution of communication is something good. Of course, it can be used to oppress people as well and to monitor people. But it's also a huge potential for good when people can organize themselves across nations, where the Myanmar opposition can stay in touch with each other, even though they're scattered all around the world. They can have a national unity government that that can organize itself and reach out to people, not as easily as it, but you can't be, I mean, only North Korea is North Korea. And no other countries can manage that. And North Korea won't be able to manage that in the long run either. You can't become an island of yourself anymore. And I think that liberal values and values of democracy and human rights are impossible to quench in the long run. And I mean, look at Russia today. Russia does evil things. They invade a smaller country. It doesn't mean that every Russian is an evil person, but they have been put through this propaganda machine for generations. But if people get objective information. If they are able to learn about the world in an unprejudiced way, they will make better decisions. I'm certain of it. Hopefully the democracies and liberal forces of the world see the danger now that's going on and will mobilize. I hope so. And in the European context, we see it where Europe has never, the European Union has never been as united as they are now with responding to Russia and sending help to Ukraine. I mean, that's a beautiful thing that we're that united. That was, I mean, during the Brexit discussions, we couldn't agree on anything. but now we understand that core European values are threatened and we need to unite to support those that fight our fight. And that's a good thing. And you see also, even though there are news reports always tell stories of failures and failed states and conflicts and war and famine, I mean, there, even though there are problems everywhere, there are places that are doing quite well as well. Look at Botswana. Who speaks about Botswana these days? But they do brilliantly.
Yeah.
And they are able to, they have natural resources and they are able to distribute it among the people and they save for future generations. And I mean, but doesn't make any headlines that things are going well in Botswana. But I mean, I believe that these places, if it can happen there, it can happen anywhere. Us who are fortunate to be born in wealthier countries with the opportunity to help, we have an obligation to help. And that saddens me really to see how nowadays the rich part of the world are stepping back, where the UK, for example, have halved their international development aid to 0.3. I mean, that's shameful. I mean, the UK is a rich country. Yeah. They should be able to do better. Sweden, we've had a 1% vision for development aid. It's been the guiding light for all governments for 50 years. This is abandoned here since the last election. With the influence from the right-wing populists, we're now moving towards, we're at 0.75. We are moving towards under 0.7, which is the UN barrier or recommended level for developed nations. And that would be a terrible shame if Sweden joined in this slippery slope. So we're fighting to restore the 1% vision again. And I hope that Sweden can be a country that has more global ambitions than we do today. I think, Sweden is not a completely different country during this administration that we have now, but we have taken steps away from the global stage. Mm-hmm. We have become more of a regional player, focusing on Ukraine and support there, and moving away from the most difficult places like Burkina Faso, Cambodia, Mali, South Sudan. We have stopped giving bilateral aid to these countries. Thankfully, we have quite a large sum set aside for Myanmar for the next few years, and I'm glad for that we have a SIDA has a strategy for Myanmar. That's good. But the trend is that we're moving away from difficult places. And the Minister of Development Aid, he has a saying, he says, we should, like a gardener say, we should water where it grows. And I'm saying we should help, we should be where it's most difficult to get things to grow. Yeah. Because we have the possibility to make it grow there. And we shouldn't just go to the easy places and do a little bit there to make things grow. Other countries will do that. We should be in the most difficult places. And I don't see that. So I'm worried if we don't win the upcoming election in Sweden 26, this slippery slope will continue. And Sweden is a small country, but we are an important role model in the world. We should be able, and we have had pride in being a humanitarian superpower. And you who work in the international aid, and you, I mean, Sweden is spoken about much more than our size justifies, you know. Yeah. And we are a big donor to many multilateral organizations, the UN system, and in the humanitarian field and human rights field and gender equality. Sweden is a big player, and we should be. We should be proud of being that, instead of saying, oh, well, someone else can pay for all that. And in these days where the US have completely abandoned their role model function in the world, where the UK is stepping back, where countries are becoming more and more focused on interior affairs, there is a vacuum where Sweden could make themselves present and could mobilize other countries in being responsible. So I wish we would have a government here that would sort of step up on the world stage, holding the banner of solidarity and saying, come on, join us. There is a lot of work to do here, and we should all help out, instead of we are one people in the world, and we need to help each other and rally other countries around that. That's my vision for Swedish politics in the future, and our presence in Burma as well, to be there in a sustainable way, to see this military junta disappear and to see a new federal state, democratic, respecting all the diversity of Myanmar, and having making use of the great potential there is in Myanmar in all senses, and not allowing Myanmar to become just a pawn in the China-US drama, with just as a place where you build ports and pipelines and mines and stuff. It deserves better.
So I thank you so much for your time. I know you have to run. We could be talking about this for hours. I wish we could, and perhaps we can continue the conversation at another point. But I want to leave you with one last question, and that's that when I prompted you before about a memory of Myanmar, you spoke of some of the difficulties, and Lord knows there's so many difficulties that people there are facing, and how those difficulties have inspired you to continue to keep that on the radar. And yet there's also a burgeoning light and inspiration from Myanmar. These are people pretty much all on their own that are working towards those values that we supposedly espouse, and yet they are actually working towards them, of a federal democracy, of human rights, of free media, of dignity for all. And so for so many of us that have watched their struggle from afar, they have given us something by showing they are on the front lines of democracy, showing us what's possible to work for things that many of us seem to take for granted. And so the last question I'd like to ask you to leave our listeners with is, if there are any examples or thoughts that you can give of seeing the way that now or in the past that those Burmese have worked towards those values in such inspirational and incredible ways that have filled or inspired us in what we're doing in much safer and more privileged contexts.
Well, I mustn't mention specific organizations or sensitive names, etc., but I've witnessed how through our partners we have educated girls and young women, and this is a core part of Swedish and social democratic value system, to have a feminist approach in things and to empower women and girls, and to let girls across the world understand and know that they are important, their voice matters, and that they can become anything they aspire to be if the conditions are right. And I've met with many Burmese, Myanmar female activists who have gone through training through our partners, and have grown to become confident leaders in their communities and true role models. That's very inspiring, even for an old man like me. And I hope to see more of that in the future. And thanks for this conversation. I enjoyed it. And I'll be happy to continue the conversation at another time.
For a lot of podcast listeners, as soon as the fundraising requests start up, you just kind of zone out till it's over, skip ahead. But if you're taking the time to listen to our full podcast episode, can I ask that you also take a moment to listen to our spiel? The reality is, creating this content takes immense effort and resources. And if you make a donation, you'll not only just be helping to keep the podcast going, you'll also be standing in solidarity with the people of Myanmar during one of the most challenging periods in their history. Please take a moment to look at insightmyanmar.org/donation for details of how you can contribute.
Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,